Hey guys, welcome to episode 300. I would like to welcome new sponsors, Strange Brew Lounge Side. Yes, I've been playing there every Tuesday for the last like month or so, and I'll be playing there until the middle of September. We've done a few live podcasts there, but Strange Brew is a great place. It's a great place to go see music. It's an amazing room, and listen, they won Best All Ages Venue, they won Best Acoustic Venue, and they won Best Live Music Venue overall. Okay, at the Austin Chronicle Music Awards for 2013-2014. So they hold that right now as we speak. Tons of people have been playing there. Let me tell you what's going on tonight, Friday, August 15th at 8 p.m. an evening with legend Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Plus, at 10 p.m., a Beatles tribute, which I think I'm going to go to and see. My friend Lonnie Trevino and a great cast of characters are going to play some deep cuts, some songs you don't normally hear, like in the pop world of Beatles stuff. Maybe some underground Beatles stuff. That's what I'm looking for. Okay, then, tomorrow morning, Saturday morning, August 16th, a free 10 a.m. kids show. CeeLo will be playing at 7 p.m., a special CD release show at 9 p.m. with Curtis McMurtry. He's releasing a new album. And of course, on Sunday morning, August 17th at 11 a.m., as always, the Purgatory Players Brunch. Featuring John Green, CeeLo, John D. Graham, Scrappy Judd Newcomb, and many, many, many more. Just go to strangebrewlounside.com to find out what's going on for ticket prices, to buy tickets, to reserve tickets, and to find out, you know, where it is, find out what's coming up, upcoming events. I know they do have a mailing list. So get over there, strangebrewlounside.com. Go to Strange Brew down there in South Austin. All right, let's get down.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Tom Howdy.
All right. Hello. Welcome to episode 300, man. I cannot believe, man, we have come this far together. 300 episodes. You guys, me, and all the guests that have been on the show. I can't believe all the guests that have been on the show. Even in just this past year, I was going through all of the episodes and trying to find the best of, sort of my favorite pieces of conversations to throw out here for you guys. And I came across them. Well, when I was going through it, there were some that I didn't even remember. I was like, oh yeah, that guy or that lady. What a great conversation we had. Man, this has been an incredible ride. 300 episodes. I can't believe I'm here. I really can't, and I'm very proud to be here. I'm glad that I've done this the whole time. I'm glad I've stuck to it, and I'm into doing it, and here we are, 300 episodes in, all right? Well, look, I'm going to talk about stuff throughout the whole thing, but first of all, I want to thank you guys, the listeners, for listening to the show, people that get involved with the show, people that came to the live podcast, all of the guests that have come to my apartment or had me to their house or to their studio or wherever it is that I've gone to meet them. The live podcasts that we've done, Strange Brew ones, that were pretty fun this year. I remember we also did, oh, maybe that was last year we did the Antones, before it closed, huh? All the people that have taken the time to listen, all the people that have taken the time to talk and be honest with me. I want to thank everyone. I want to thank my sponsors, especially Space, for sticking through with us this whole time. Going through, Hello Giggles, Modern Outsider, and now we welcome Strange Brew, where I have a Tuesday night residency. And I've been having a great time doing that residency. And I realize that everyone that's been a guest on my residency, I have two guests per show. Everybody has been on the podcast. So that's really cool. The podcast has really opened up a lot of stuff for me. And I've gotten to meet a lot of really cool people. And I've gotten to some really great experiences out of it. Like I met Kimmy Rhodes on the podcast. Then she asked me to send her some of my songs. So I did. She ended up liking one of my songs so much she wanted to cut it on her record. And I ended up playing on her whole record. Playing piano, playing guitar, singing. We sang my song, I Am Falling, as a duet. I mean, this has opened up some great doors for me. I've been invited to host some events That's been great. And it's all because of this, the podcast. It's opening doors. It's made my life infinitely better. And I love talking to my friends and making friends through it. Imagine all the friends I've made. Kimmy Rhodes, that's a friend. Made friends with the Mastersons through it. I've become friends through Steve Poltz, even though I kind of knew him before. Through the podcast, we've become pals, man. There's people who now I text back and forth. Otis the Destroyer, Leopold and his fiction. Just people that I've met through this thing and become friends with. Very good friends. All right? The comics. I've enjoyed it, man. I love doing How Did I Get Here. I love that you guys listen to it, and I appreciate it 100%. So thank you for making the last 300 episodes so great, all right, for me. I hope they've been great for you as well. Well, where do we start? Let's start with the wacky guy that I met during South by Southwest. I had Scorpion Child in here at one point. And their manager came over with them. And then when he was leaving, he was like, hey, have you ever heard of B.P. Fallon? And I was like, yeah, of course I have. This guy's legendary. I mean, this guy, I can't even begin to tell you. He worked for the Beatles. He was T-Rex's publicist. He was the publicist for Led Zeppelin on tour in the 70s. The longest line of stuff. And he was in Austin during South by Southwest. Weston McGowan, his manager, was like, hey, I'll take you to him. We'll go over there. We'll talk to him and you can get into his thing because he just put out an album, B.P. Fallon and the Bandits. Great band. Clem Burke's in the band. Jerry Harrison's in the band, both from Blondie. Anyway, look, I went over there. I talked to him. And at this point in the conversation, he was telling me how he first got in to the Beatles camp by going to John and Yoko's hotel room in Amsterdam when they were having their famous bed in and just making his way up and interviewing him. All right, here we go. It's my conversation with B.P. Fallon from back in March. Let's get down. When you first started, you were a journalist, and
I was never a journalist. A writer.
Okay, you were a writer, and you got in to speak with John and Yoko during the bed-in into Amsterdam.
Yes.
Okay. Who were you writing for, and how did you get in there? Did you know them before that, or?
No.
Okay.
Who was I writing for?
Yeah, yourself.
Myself, really, yeah. And then I sold it to Melody Maker.
Okay.
In England, did I know them? No, I just arrived and said I'm here.
Okay.
Rang up, you know.
Right, right.
Come over from Ireland to talk to you. Right. Can you come up now? You know.
Yeah.
I think so. All right, John, if you insist. I did all this verbally. It was great. And then when they threw out all these straight sort of lunchtime oboes journalists who'd flown over for the day from London.
Right.
Because John and Yoko were on their honeymoon.
Right.
And they were in bed.
Right.
What could they be doing?
Right.
And they were awfully disappointed because they were talking about acorns and white bicycles and stuff like that. And these people were very unhappy about that. And then when they threw them out, they invited me to stay, and we had a good old chin wagon stuff and watched them the two of them on TV and talked about brown rice and acid and things like that. So I went back to the people with whom I was staying, the wavy gravy people, and said, oh, you've got to listen to this, John and Yoko. Yeah. Played my tape recorder.
Oh, no.
So the batteries were fucked. So you either jump out the window or you do what I did, was I rang up John Lennon and I said, you know, remember that stuff we did today? Yeah, it was really good. I said, well, the problem is the batteries were no good. Well, can you come round tomorrow again? Yes, I can. So that's how I met him. I forget what the question was, though.
Well, I was just wondering how you got into... Then you ended up working with Derek
Apple,
Taylor.
Derek Taylor. Wonderful man. If you don't know who Derek Taylor is, he was not only the Beatles press officer, but he was something of a guru to John Lennon and George Harrison. And to me, without him realizing it, I used to watch him and I learned from him.
You learned, yeah. And you switched from being writer, as a press officer, that's what people now would call a publicist?
Yes.
Okay. And you kind of switched sides?
Not really. I mean, because it's the same boogaloo, you know?
Okay.
I mean, you write about stuff because you want to turn people on.
Right.
The other one is the same. You get paid a lot of money if you're successful at it, which I'm told I was. And you get paid money to talk about your friends who you love.
Yeah.
And you see them every night playing.
Yeah.
And you travel the world with them, you know? And we share toys.
Yeah. So did you were you working handling the publicity when they split up and stuff? Oh. The Beatles?
No, I wasn't their publicist.
Oh no, but you worked with Derek Taylor, right? Yes. But what were you doing with Derek? Just assisting, or that's what I was trying to get at. Sorry.
I was doing things like writing bios on Billy Preston and Jimmy and
other Apple artists.
James Taylor,
Jackie Lomax.
No, I didn't work with him, although I knew him. One day Derek said to me, you know, you seem to know about these things. Do you want to become Paul McCartney's grass tester? Oh, all right, if you insist. So that was one of the jobs I had at Apple. I took it very seriously, you know, I didn't just rush through it. It sometimes took me days. And nobody complained.
Yeah. How does it strike you now that you see legalization in two states here in the United States, when back then, you know, you would get busted for a seed and go to jail for forever or however long?
I think it's very healthy.
Very healthy, yeah.
Very healthy. You know, I'm not a... I don't, you know, that doesn't mean everyone has to do it if they don't want to do it.
Right, right.
But, you know, it's meant to be a free society here.
Right.
And I don't see why a government should have any say in what you put into your body. Because the next thing they'll say, well, we can't have carrots. You're going to jail. You ate three carrots.
Right.
You know? And it's medicine.
Yeah.
Or it's enjoyable. Or you don't do it at all.
Right.
It's up to you. And it's ludicrous that it's illegal. You know, some student getting into trouble because they had like a five spot or something.
Right.
It's mad. It's a plant, you know. Would I make all drugs legal? Yes, I would. Even heroin. Not because I think heroin's a good idea. I think it's an appalling idea. But less people would die because it would be purer. Yeah. And you get rid of the criminal element.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
And it doesn't mean that everyone's suddenly going to be pinned. You know, you go,
right.
You go to Amsterdam,
right,
where people think weed is legal. It's not.
Right.
But they have a thing called the blind eye policy,
right,
where they don't bother. And you, when you walk around there, do you see all these people wafting around out of their trolley? No, you don't.
No.
You know?
No.
And prohibition doesn't work. They have this expression, the war on drugs. Fantastic slogan. What does it mean? Nothing.
No.
It's, you know, it's like the war on terror. What does it mean? Nothing.
No.
And these are sort of camouflage things that people hide behind, you know. And it will become legal everywhere in America because people don't mind it.
Do you feel like it would become more legal more quickly if there was like some big business behind it? Like some...
What do you mean if?
Conoco, or you think there is behind legalization of marijuana? Well, there will be, yeah.
There will be. The other reason why it will become legal is because of the money to be made.
Yeah, there's a lot.
A lot of money.
Yeah, and it can help. You know, the...
You know, it can help hospitals, cancer research, AIDS research, etc.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the reasons it hasn't been legal is because people who sit there smoking weed are less liable to go off to war and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if they're drunk, you're drunk and rush over the barricades,
bayoneting
some poor fellow who's a carpenter for the opposing side, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so in... Sorry, let's go back to the 70s and the story of B.P. Fallon. You then went to work with Led Zeppelin, is that right, chronologically? After you tested the weed for Paul McCartney?
No, I became Ireland's press officer for a
while. Oh, okay, right. I didn't know if that came first.
Then I did some stuff with T-Rex, and then Led Zeppelin.
What was your experience with Mark Bolan? I'm a huge fan. I grew up, my mom was a big fan of his, and I always felt like we were like the only family in America with their records.
He's a magic man.
Yeah. Yeah, I even have one of his poetry books that a fan of mine gave to me in Atlanta or something. It's great stuff.
He was a special man in special times. It was the first big mega band since the Beatles. And they all paid homage. This is T-Rex I'm talking about.
Yes.
You know, George and Mark were friends, Mark Bolan. Ringo, of course, made the film Born to Boogie.
Right, which I love. I love that movie. It was hard to find in the 90s when I found it. I ended up owning a VHS copy of it. Like that was a dubbed one. But one of the things that stood out to me was there was a really long scene of a guy, mouse driving Mark Bolan and I think Ringo down in this like a convertible down a real long runway. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed like it was madness, like kind of what I would imagine. It had that same kind of vibe as like Magic Christian, like that zany kind of...
Yeah, it's
of
two
like,
friends having fun.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I got
quoting Shakespeare badly and stuff.
Yeah. So was that a lot of fun to be around? Was the whole T-Rex experience as fun as someone like me being a fan would have thought it was?
It was magical. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. What happened was it was Tyrannosaurus Rex before that.
Right.
Which was kind of hippy-dippy. Very cool. And, you know, the girls would offer to read your tarot and the boys would offer to give you hash, you know.
Right.
And then suddenly became more sexual. Got more horny.
Yeah. Definitely. And the music definitely reflected that so well.
But also it wasn't vulgar or tacky. It was with a smile.
No.
It was quite gentle. You know, it wasn't your hammer on the head stuff, you know.
No. No, those guys had a good sense of humor.
Very good, you know.
Yeah.
And with the right touchstones as well, like, you know, Erling Wolf or Chuck Berry and stuff like that, you know.
Were you around bands like Roxy Music and other bands that were around at that
Never
scene?
Worked with them.
No.
But it was around.
You know? Yeah. Did you, that must have been a great time. That's like one of my favorite times in music, that 70s. It never really kind of moved, it never really hit in the States outside of Bowie, you know, and maybe just, you know, one T-Rex song, which is sad. But over there, it was...
A way of life.
It was a way of life. Yeah. How true is like a movie, was it Velvet Goldmine? You saw this, did you? No? Oh. I just wondered if that really gave off a sense of what that was like
I'm told not.
What? No?
No.
Okay. That seems...
It's meant to be about David and Iggy, you know.
Right. Were you around those guys much?
Not David, really. Iggy a bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, in America, yeah. I mean, I used to come to my room at the Continental Hyatt House and with his girlfriend, Coral, who was the sister of Sable Starr, who's a friend of mine. And he would order room service and these trays would come up on trolleys. But I didn't know this was happening. I mean, I did, but I didn't let on. A fellow had no money.
Right.
You know, he's always remembered that, which is nice.
What was that hold? What was the Continental Hyatt House? The Riot House? Or is that just madness then? The loaves and the fishes, it all comes together, more than serendipitous. Nobody's alone. We're all in this together.
BP Fallon. We went off a little bit in the drug war thing, but I thought that was an interesting thing. Being Paul McCartney's weed tester. Okay. BP Fallon, what an interesting cat. I'm glad I got to meet him. He was a little, I mean, you heard it. I was trying to do some stuff and there was some avoidance and kind of, he was a little shut down about some stuff. But look, I had a great time talking to him and he invited me to hang out later. So we ended up being friends. You can go back and listen to that episode. It's back there. All right, let's go up to a newer episode. This summer, my friend Kelly McWee from the Trishas put out an album. It's called You Used to Live Here. And she came over and we had a long talk about stuff. And we were talking about the Trishas and how fast everything happened for them. They were an all female band. And the thing was that Kelly wasn't a songwriter at the time. She had been in bands where she had been surrounded by songwriters. And then all of a sudden, she was tapped to write songs. They got a big publishing deal, and she had to go write songs with real professional songwriters. And she told me that story. She ended up being a great songwriter. Her new album, You Used to Live Here, is incredible, and it's all songs she wrote. But back when she was thrown into it, she was definitely thrown into fire. Let's talk to Kelly McWee about being thrown into the songwriting fire.
He was cool with you guys saying no to Sony and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
he was.
He was. Mm-hmm. And he was still stand behind you.
Yeah. We right after that we got offered a publishing deal at Warner Chappell.
Uh-huh.
So we took that because it seemed like
a good idea.
Yeah. It was really gonna nurture our, you know, I mean, Savannah had just written maybe a few songs until the Trishas. I had never written a song ever. And really didn't have any interest in it because I love to sing. Singing's the only thing I feel like I'm really good at and really comfortable at, you know? So I didn't even really care. I mean, Jed was the songwriter in that duo. And Jamie and Liz were the songwriters in the Trishas until we got a publishing deal. And Savannah as well. But we got this publishing deal and it was like I was literally forced to go sit in rooms with people.
Did you in Nashville?
Yeah.
How was that? Did you write with anyone that wrote anything that we know?
Yeah.
Luke Bryan, who I'm obsessed with.
Does he write songs?
I don't know.
Huh.
I don't. All I know is that one song, and I get really excited when it comes on because it's terrible.
What is it?
That's my kind of night.
Oh yeah. God. What's the deal with that guy? He's kind of cute.
That song starts off with no, no.
No, he's not cute.
No. No, 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 he's not. And if he wants to fight, that's fine. But, because I'm sure he listens to my podcast all the time. No, he's got glow-in-the-dark white teeth. Like that episode of Friends when Ross gets the fluorescent teeth. I swear to God, it's disturbing. It's
well,
not
maybe they're
natural.
Not his teeth. You never know.
Maybe they're the bass player's teeth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some cats.
So who did you write with?
Oh, man.
I was on Warner Chappell, and I had to go and do that. But in L.A., I didn't do it in Nashville.
Oh, I wonder what that was like. I mean, I wonder the difference there. Probably
you
not much.
You go to dudes' houses and chicks' houses.
Yeah, we did a few houses. Like, people we kind of knew a little bit, like Gary Nicholson or someone like that.
Who's that?
Who's Gary Nicholson?
Yeah, he sounds famous.
well, he's a pretty well-known songwriter, for sure. Like, Delbert McClinton and...
Okay.
Vince Gill, and I mean, you know, he's got hits all day long.
But did they put you, but, like, with who, like, oh, this guy wrote the Taylor Swift song?
Yeah. You know, I need to go back and just look through all my notes in my notepad from those years, you know, where I would write the songs or listen to the demos and write down everyone's name. You know, like, my very first writing appointment, the very, very first one was with Rodney Foster. My first writing a song experience was with him, which, I mean, I was just crying the whole time because I was so uncomfortable.
Oh my God, you had to go into a room. Did you have anything, like, I'm surely you had, like, something like, oh, I've got this thing, it's like a, I don't know what you do, you know, something?
Yeah, but, okay, like, good. It was dumb. It was like, it was just like, you don't miss the water till the well runs dry. I remember I had that written down, and he was like, that's already a song.
Like, that's like 12 songs.
That's like 12 songs. And I was like, oh. Okay. Like, well, I still kind of want to write it. And he's like, okay, geez, you know. And I think most people that wrote with us saw us as an artist. So, like, I'm going to, you know, not like, oh, these are serious songwriters. I really would love to hear what they have to say or you know. I think
I've got your hit.
Yeah. And so they would try to write cheesy ass. Can I cuss? Is cussing?
Yeah, cussing. Cussing is super
It
cool.
was the cheesiest shit, seriously, sometimes. Like, I won't even say their names because that's what they do. And I think that when they got set up to write with one of us or two of us, at first I was always with one other girl until I got comfortable doing it on my own. But I think that they would look at us and go, okay, this is an artist. So now I've got to make sure I write the most commercial thing. They're chicks. They're, you know.
Same as me when I was in those situations. It wasn't like, hey, let's write a song. It was like, I'm writing your single.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was bad. I mean, I left so many times just seriously crying. Like,
really?
What the hell? Yeah. And then I had those experiences, you know, with people.
Well, you guys just got thrown. I mean, you got thrown in the deep end. You had never written a song and someone stuck you in a room with Rodney Foster.
Yeah.
In a bad cliche.
And this... that was mine.
Kelly Mickwey. Well, she doesn't have that problem anymore, man. Pick up her album, You Used to Live Here, and you'll find out she's got no songwriting problems anymore. All right? Kelly Mickwey's a fantastic thing. I love her story. That was fantastic. Next up, we're going to talk to an old friend of mine who stopped by for his second time on the show, a dear old friend of mine, my friend Billy Harvey. He's been living out in L.A. He's actually, you know what? He's making a record currently with Salim Nirala producing. Love Salim. Love him. Anyway, so Billy Harvey stopped by, and he's making a new record, as I said. And also, he's been playing with Katie Sagal from Married with Children and Sons of Anarchy. Anyway, Billy stopped by when he was here. I can't even remember when it was. Anyway, he stopped by. Oh, he was here playing a show or something. And he stopped by. We had a long talk about it, and I asked him about playing with Katie Sagal. He told me about it, what the band was like and what the experience was like, and we had a good laugh. He's a great guy, Billy Harvey. Love him. Let's talk to him right now.
it. I'm not a fortune teller. I got future shock. I'm not a bad man. I'm religious. I'm not a hero. I'm a rock.
Good. That's why he said you can put those on.
Right, I don't know how to start them. So, Billy Harvey, you're in Austin, Texas. You used to live here, but now you live in Los Angeles, California. What's going on with you and Katie Seagal? I've seen a lot of pictures of you playing with her. That looks amazing.
It's fun. It's really cool. It's surreal to be playing with, you know, Peg Bundy, and but everyone's so nice, and the music's really good, and I realized that she's a singer. I mean, even as she lists herself, it's singer actress, and she's sung background vocals with Bob Dylan and a bunch of other people.
Still, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's cool. And the guys in the band are legendary. I feel like I'm going to get fired every single rehearsal and every single gig.
But no, man,
they keep calling me back. And, you know, Greg Leese is in the band.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's, you know, I'll have an example of, how intimidating this is for me. We played one show. Well, I don't like playing guitar solos with Greg Leese anywhere near me.
Right.
Because he's so awesome. And, you know, he's looking at me and he might be going, wow, I like that guy. I like how he plays. But I'm thinking he's going, what the fuck is he doing playing? I'm over here.
Yeah.
But we played a show in L.A., which was definitely my favorite show. The band is the Forest Rangers. Bob Thiel does all the music for Sons of Anarchy, and he does a great job at the music for that show. And so he put a band together so that they could play those songs and that style of music,
right?
You know, in the real world. And Katie Seagal is, you know, the star and a great singer. So there's other singers that join us. You know, the theme song is sung by Curtis Stigers, and you know, he came out with us once. And so we have some guys and some guest singers along. So it's Katie Seagal and the Forest Rangers and special guests. Like, it's a, you know, it feels like P-Funk or something. There's like 22 people in the band. But we played a show in L.A. It was, you know, when you play a show in L.A. or New York, for some reason you put all this pressure on yourself. It's like, this has to be the pinnacle. And fortunately, it was a good show. But we did a song called For a Dancer that Jackson Brown wrote. And they're all friends. And Jackson does a duet on one of Katie's songs.
Oh, wow.
And he was coming to the show. And so I'm like, you know, learning the song, and I'm researching it. Like, I want to be as familiar with it as they all are. And so I YouTube it. And I find videos of For a Dancer being performed on the internet, and I see one. It's Emmy Lou Harris on David Letterman in like 1989.
Wow.
Covering For a Dancer, and on guitar is Greg Leese playing a jazz master, which is what I play.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, damn it, I can't escape that guy.
I didn't realize that. I thought he was younger than that. For some reason. He looks young, right?
Everyone in the band, I don't know how old anybody is. And if I did, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, because Katie Seagal does not look the age. She looks younger now than the character Peg Bundy looked. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, she looks great. I mean, there's a youthful.
She also looks more like a person because that was such a cartoony look.
Yeah. I mean, when you're doing art
keeps you young.
Yeah, it does keep you young. You know, I don't know. I don't know how many of them have kids. I think kids ages you, probably.
Yeah.
I don't have any yet. But it
probably also matures you a little bit.
Matures you, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's a really cool band to be in. And I feel, you know, very inspired. as not just intimidated, but I'm also inspired to be playing with those guys. And
that's amazing.
We don't play that often, so it's like once every 4 months. So
oh, okay.
It's, you know, but who knows? I don't know when we'll play next.
Great Billy Harvey. What a great guy, man. That guy's super funny. It's a great story, man. Must be super fun doing that Sons of Anarchy tour like he does. Katie Segal sounds fantastic. My AC is on, but you know what, man? I'm just going with it. This is episode 300, and I'm relaxed. I'm in a relaxed situation. I'm in a bathing suit, just a t-shirt. My friend Einar is coming over to hang out. Maybe I'll get him in on the next segment to talk. All right, that was Billy Harvey, great friend of mine, amazing musician, great producer, great actor. Look into his episode. Always an entertaining conversation with Billy Harvey. Next up, producer Adrian Quesada, who is now a member of Spanish Gold. He was on, I met him at an Elliott Smith tribute concert last year in October. My friend David put it on. Adrian was a guitar player. I'd heard of him before. We ended up kind of getting to know each other through the rehearsals and at the show. I invited him to be on the show so we could talk. He produces a lot of great records. He was in Grupo Fantasma and stuff. And so anyway, he came over and talked about it. He's since, you know, Spanish Gold has blown up this summer. And you know from the last episode that Out on the Street is my summer jam. Anyway, this story is specifically about Grupo Fantasma was nominated for a Grammy twice. Once they went and they didn't win. The second time, they didn't go, and they won. This is the story of that. My friend, Adrian Quesada, from Spanish Gold, telling the story about Grupo Fantasma not winning Grammy and then winning Grammy. Let's get down, people. Can we just go back to the days of Ricky Martin when the Latin explosion was happening?
Exactly.
I knew then that, I mean, I'm Cuban, you're Latin, guys like David, guys like Vallejo, all these guys, I was like, guys, we got 45 minutes to capitalize on our heritage, because it's going to go away and it's not going to be that big of a deal.
Well, it's funny because the number, like, for everything you hear is like, you know, it's like Latinos are like the fastest growing population, and pretty much probably is apparently going to outnumber.
I think we outnumber white people
already. Yeah. But it's, you don't see those numbers. It just doesn't add up.
So was it a Grammy that was presented at the show? Did you get to, were you on TV?
No, I didn't go that year. I went the first year that we got nominated and didn't win.
Why didn't you go the second year?
It's a long story, but the first year, no, they do. There's like, I don't know, a couple hundred or a few hundred categories. They only televise like 15. They only televise like rap, you know, rock, the main super main ones. But like all the other ones, like the classical and
jazz,
polka,
folk,
whatever, all that. Those are actually done in the ceremony before the televised part in a smaller, like, or a big ballroom, but it's not like as glamorous as it is on TV. However, they did give us tickets, so I did go to that. But the first year, I swore we were going to win. I mean, we went in there and I had a speech and I was just like, and we didn't win. The next year, they gave us 4 tickets for a 10-piece band with like crew and everything. It was super lame and it was kind of annoying, and they would not budge on that, because the first year they gave us all tickets. And then we also had the option to buy girlfriends or wives extra tickets. So like we all took our wives and girlfriends, and super fun night. You know, we got to see like the televised part, which was a spectacle.
It's not boring?
No, it was actually pretty fun. Okay. It's kind of fun because it's just whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You're at the Grammys, whatever.
Yeah.
But wasn't something I'd want to go to every year. I think it was just one of those bucket list things.
You went to the Grammys.
Yeah. And the next time they offered us 4 tickets, and we were like, all right, so this is a 10-piece band, and they wouldn't budge. So it was like, so here we are, like all fighting for 4 tickets. At that point, I didn't think we were going to win. I really didn't. I just totally didn't think we were going to win. And I was just kind of jaded by the whole thing, and it was just like, whatever. I'll opt out of this. You guys can fight for the tickets. And eventually, actually, it was funny because it ended up that one ticket just went to waste. We ended up with just 3 people going to the Grammys. So we drove up there, booked some shows on the way up to just kind of pay for it, and played the night before in LA and turned around and just drove home. But we stopped at a truck stop to, because you could stream the Grammys or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we just totally thought, it was funny, because the night before we were leaving and we were all kind of drunk and we stopped at like a Walgreens or something and I bought a, what's the like shitty champagne that like is in the commercial?
Andre.
No, it's a Korbel, right?
Yeah, Korbel.
So I bought a bottle of Korbel and was like, just in case we win, and it just kind of was funny. We stopped at a truck stop and tried to like stream it. Kind of made this like big scene in there, and like all these truck drivers were around us, and it wasn't really like we couldn't really get the internet connection and stuff. But I was on the phone with my wife, and we were all checking it out, and we had all these truck drivers that were like, they're nominated for a Grammy, and we were like, yeah, we're trying to watch. And I was on the phone with my wife, and we were like, the streaming thing was like super slow and like 4 seconds behind, you know. So they were like about to get to it and whatever. And my wife just goes, "You want a fucking Grammy?" And I was like, "We want a fucking Grammy!" It turned into this party at the truck stop. We bought a bunch of beer. And we had a bus at the time. We actually got on the bus, like started drinking beer, and then I was like, "I got Korbel." We like popped a bottle of Korbel. Is it Korbel? I don't know. Anyways, shitty champagne. And then and we had a little party on the bus, and then our bus broke down. our bus driver got sick. That's what it was. Oh. In Arizona, and like 2 hours later, all of a sudden he got super sick. So he.
Adrian Quesada, extremely talented man and extremely fun to talk to, man. Great storyteller, man. I loved that podcast. So you guys go back, I think it's episode 213. Go on back, check it out, listen to the whole thing because it's that entertaining. He tells stories about playing with Prince, everything, man. It's fantastic. All right, so speaking of playing with celebrities, our next guest is Mike Flanagan. He was back here, I think it was like in January. I reached out to him. He has a group called Dupree. He's also Mike Flanagan. But I saw that he was doing all this touring and stuff with Billy Gibbons, that he had gone out and played with ZZ Top. And he came back, and man, it was a great story about how he was a guitar guy. And he had grown up playing little keyboards, but he was a guitar guy, and then he just got into the organ. And he just sat around his house and he practiced. And now he's out there playing with Billy Gibbons. He's making a record with him. It's this fantastic story. Anyway, this story that he tells is about playing Billy Gibbons' birthday up in New York with Will Lee and Anton Figg from the Late Night with David Letterman band. And it's a pretty exciting story. And it's interesting. He's so humble. He's so cool. And he's playing with all these other cats. You find out really all the other guys are just like you and me, man. We're just trying to do what we do well. Not counting beans or doing any kind of shit. Like, just trying to play good. That's all everyone's trying to do. And it's true. Play well is what I mean. But it sounds better when you say everyone's just trying to play good. That sounds real. Mike Flanagan came over. We had a great conversation. You should go back and listen to the whole thing. It's incredibly entertaining, and he's a soulful, soulful cat. So here's Mike Flanagan talking about playing Billy Gibbons' birthday party with him up in New York City. All right, here you go.
I mean, they're so unique, you know, and they're so good, and they're so different, right? Yeah. Everybody's so different. Like, I'm in a constant awe of who I get to meet.
Yeah.
And not just musicians, too, just people. I mean, I just like...
Who did anyone cool come out and jam on the Gibbons' birthday this last week in New
York? Well, you know, my big
thing.
Oh, you
were playing with
that.
Anton Figg and
Will Lee from the Letterman band. That was the rhythm section, right? And so, of course, I'd never met those guys or played with them. And so, I don't really get nervous anymore, but because I think, hey, you know,
I'm here for a reason.
I mean, I can play. Like, one thing I know. Like, okay, I know I can play, right? So, whether somebody likes it or not, that's another thing. And also, my approach to playing is, I realize to be able to play something that seems, like, really beyond your limits, your capabilities, like, to really go for it and have that really magical minute there, right, like, during when you're playing, is that you have to be willing to make mistakes. And so I factor that in. And I'm not afraid to hit clunkers, and sometimes that's all you'll hit, you know. You have to be willing to do that.
Those guys know that.
Yeah. So, but you know, sometimes when you do play, and I realize, like, that's my mindset, And you could have a different mindset and you could play everything you know and it would be really good, you know. And I'm not saying I don't play like that sometimes, but my goal is not worry about notes, really. And so, but sometimes when you play with guys like that, you're like, oh, man, is it going to be one of those nights that I just start clunking or something? Maybe it will be. Yeah. I don't know. So I'm always a little nervous that that might happen. But they were great.
But there wasn't like any Steve Vai kind of guys didn't come out?
No, Greg Allman came out, which was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, I saw a picture of that.
That was pretty cool. He came back, and he was really complimentary and nice.
You guys talk organ stuff?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, we talked organ stuff. And there was a lot of organ players at that gig, man. Like, guys I didn't know, but people that played with, you know, people. And
how's Gibbons to work with, like, even, like, just on a rehearsal thing? Is it fun? Just fun?
Well, it was fun because, like, even that, we never rehearsed for it, you know? Like, we just sound checked, and then we're like, what's going to be the end or whatever? But those guys, I mean, those Letterman guys, you know, they played with each other. It's just like a machine, you know? They're there, you know? You just have to put some frosting on it. But it was funny. Like, Will Lee came in, and there was some song we were doing, and he had some sheet music for it, you know? He gave it to me, and But, you know, I can't read, you know, which always is funny because obviously a lot of people can't read in musicians.
Right.
But you always think the keyboard player can read because that's the guy that was taking piano lessons when he was five, you know.
Right.
That guy can always read. Yeah. No one else can read. And so I always feel weird, like, well, I can't read. But that's not how I came up, you know. So, but anyway, he was really cool about it. He was like, oh, no, don't worry about it. I said, just tell me what it is. And he did. And then later on, I told him the story of how I started to play, you know. And so those guys, you know, they loved it. I mean, and they were
so
super,
cool.
Super nice. And, really.
Cool. Let me ask you this. Here's a question that I've been wanting to ask for a while because I wanted to ask Van when he was on here too. Is what songs did you guys play when you played with ZZ Top at Montreux?
Yeah, we played. I'm trying to think. We did this song Kiko, which is a Jimmy McGriff kind of little instrumental thing, and then that has since morphed into because we did this Daryl Hall TV show.
Oh yeah, that's right. Tell me.
That has since Kiko is. It was an instrumental. And then Gibbons added words, let's have a party, right? So that turned into let's have a party. But at the ZZ Top show, we did Kiko. And then he gave me, because we were doing this, the reason that I was there, you know, was because they were doing this tribute to Claude Knobs, the founder.
Right.
And so they wanted to do something jazzy, in there.
Right.
And so we did Kiko, and then they gave me just, I played solo organ, ballad, jazz ballad, you know. It was just like, that was weird too. It was like spotlight on me in the middle of the ZZ Top show, and then it was just me for a few minutes, you know, just playing jazz ballad, you know. And then we segued into Dusty singing I Loved a Woman, that Freddie King tune.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Slow blues. So that's what we did.
I like Dusty singing too.
Oh, I love Dusty.
Into his, like...
I had never met him. Of course, I had met Billy, but I'd never met him.
The great Mike Flanagan. If you're in Austin on a Friday or Saturday night, ever, if you live in Austin or if you're traveling to Austin, come to Austin. You're here on a Friday or Saturday night. Go to the Continental Club Gallery on Friday or Saturday night. Usually Dupree or Mike is up there playing. He always has guest guitar players that will blow your mind. Denny Freeman, Jimmy Vaughn, Billy Gibbons, all kinds of folks. Anyway, that's Mike Flanagan. What a great guy. What a great story. Let's move on to my next conversation. Took place at South by Southwest. It took place just before South by Southwest started rolling. And it was the week after Ume's album Monuments came out. And Lauren from Ume came by for a second interview to talk about making the album, talk about, you know, getting ready to do this giant tour, which, man, they have blown up, huh? They are everywhere, man. She got flown out to play at the Bridge School benefit, the Neil Young thing. She played with Nancy Wilson. I heard that during some kind of in-town thing that was going on here, Sammy Hagar had her come out and play with him. I mean, she's really turned into quite a guitar hero. So this was right at the beginning. The record had just come out the week before. She stopped by in between a lot of interviews, sat down, chilled out. We had a little coffee and talked. And here's my conversation with one of my favorite guitar players and one of my favorite bands that's come out in the last few years. This is Lauren Larson from the great band Ume. Well, you know,
almost
man,
covered the record.
Record really sounds like $1 million, man. Oh, it really you. Does. I mean,
yeah,
you guys.
With Adam's approach, it was really stripped down. It's getting the sounds out of the amp. You know, just putting a 57 up there, close mic, loud amp technique.
He's amazing at that.
And we captured the sounds really raw, and there was not a lot of, you know, no post production or studio trickery. It was just like, let's capture how this.
So how
sounds.
Did you do it when you went in there? Like, how do you guys write the song? Do you write the songs yourself and then you bring them, or do you guys kind of jam out and then you write melody
it's
and lyrics?
It's all the above.
Okay.
Some of the songs, you know, were a torturous experience for years, and then we go in there and change them in the studio. Some I wrote in the studio. Actually, in one night, I'm a bit of an insomniac, and I was up till about 4 or 5 a.m., and I wrote two or three of the songs on the record right then and there.
Wow.
So,
and you
I was just inspired. Yeah.
Just brought them in the next day, and how did you guys record them? Did you do it old school, like you showed the guys the song, and then they just, boom, turned on recording?
Yeah, sometimes. Like, I think on Embrace, we just started, you know, with the guitar, tracked that, and then, you know, come in and put in the drums. Others, we did it, you know, rhythm first and built up. Some we just tracked live, so.
How much time, so did you spend a lot of time, well, I guess being on the road for that long, you really got it down. Like, you got your thing down. So when you cut the tracks, it wasn't laborious to get a song down.
No, the music
aspect. It doesn't
sound
like it by any means.
Yeah, the music aspect's never that difficult as far as guitar. I have vocal anxiety, you know, I'm very nervous and
really
never felt that confident as a singer, and this is actually Adam helped me a ton in the studio with that. I was kind of person thinking I've got to do 20-30 takes, and we would do 3 or 4 takes and he goes, you got it.
Yeah.
And I said, no, there's no way. He's like, don't listen to it, step away from it. And
yeah,
I want to, you know, very OCD about this, and I would I trusted him.
That's
came
good.
Back 2 days later. Yeah, he was right.
Sometimes it's so hard to let go of those reins. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Let someone else take your baby and do stuff to it. You know what I mean?
But he just helped me. He was more like, this is what you sound like. This is the song. If there's a little imperfection here or something that I think is, you know, oh, that's off. I think people
it's
like
character.
That. Yeah, people like that.
There was a point where I started working with producers that I think really cared, and they'd be like, oh, that's it. And I'd be like, oh, God, I sound like a thing. And he's like, no, dude, it has a thing. And then over time, you go back and listen to it, and you're like, oh, I would have sung this like a flat thing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have had a character.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was looking for that, and he had a good ear for that. He had a good ear for performance, for sure.
Yeah, it's about the performance, not about perfection.
Yeah. Did he mess with any of the songs? Like, hey, repeat this, or let's add a chorus here, or do this? Was he that kind of producer?
We did a little bit of that. Yeah. But it was, you know, he's pretty hands-off. I mean, there were times like, hey, let's repeat this part, or let's shorten this part, or hey, y'all are doing this tempo change, just keep it consistent the whole way through, you know.
Right.
And, you know, little things like that I think helps some songs and just tighten them up a bit. But
so he worked
it was
like
very collaborative,
guy.
Though.
Yeah,
but it wasn't. He was actually more hands-off than other people we've worked with in the past.
Oh, that's cool.
So it was cool, yeah. Just real, real relaxed.
Yeah. And obviously got great vocal takes out of you.
Yeah, I was excited.
Yeah. So did you do a release show already? You haven't. It just came out last week, and you've got all this stuff this week.
Yeah, it hasn't even been out a week. We did a show at Waterloo Records on Friday, an in-store. And then it's weird, you know, during South by, because there's so many free shows. So, you know, we're just going to play 6 free shows this week and then hit the road.
Yeah. Tell me about that. Like, have you been in the position in South by Southwest where your record is out and there's a machine going and you've got everything's lined up? And I'm sure this is not your only day of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And since you live here, luckily you're not coming in like Wednesday, so you have all this whole week to kind of spread it out. But how is that difference for you? Like, is there a difference? Like, do you feel like, oh, this really works well when your record's coming out and someone's pushing it, as opposed to being a band from Iowa who wants to get discovered? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, South by Southwest is chaos all around, I think.
It is chaos,
you know,
but sometimes...
I think it's...
I read a thing where a guy was saying that South by Southwest is like going into a stadium that's filled with people that are all screaming something, and you're trying to get them to listen to you.
Yeah.
With no, like, You're just like, hey, me, I'm over here. Yeah, I got a song and I'm in the parking lot of like a trailer food place and I don't know what's going on. But, no, you know, do you know what I'm saying? Like I went through South by Southwest where I was trying to quote it like, oh, man, I hope someone walks in and sees my band. Like, whatever you think that is. And so then also I've been on a label where like fucking this was like, this is where you can do fucking 40 interviews in a week. Everyone's here. You can really do this. We're going to show you to this. We're going to do that. And that really seems to work. Like, oh, well, that in place, like when you're in a different echelon of it and you've got the machine kind of works for you as opposed to like keeping you down underwater.
Yeah. I've done this so many years now.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're grateful now. I feel like this is what we've been working towards.
Right.
And South by really supported us this year. You know, we got this Blondie show. Now it's just a matter of us being able to get the people in who want to see us.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of negates the purpose. But if people can't even get in to see us. But I've done it many years and started off with very high expectations. And actually, my South by Southwest tragedy was several years ago. First show, one of the only shows I ever canceled. I was super sick, had a flu, totally lost my voice. We had a show at 3 o'clock on Friday. I said, I'll just give it to my friends from out of town, from New York. They never get to play here.
That's nice.
So they did this show and they go, best show ever. they go, Thurston Moore and all the guys from Sonic Youth came out to see us. And I was like, wait a minute. And so they go, a bunch of labels did too. And I ended up finding out later that Thurston Moore actually came to that show to see us. He posted on his old blog, you know, whom I never got to see. And so maybe it could have happened 4 years ago. I don't know. Yeah. But,
well, you know what? Those things happen for a reason.
Oh, I'm grateful to, definitely grateful to be where we are. But I don't cancel a show now, even if I can't sing.
I do that. Lauren Larson, the amazing band Ume, man. If you don't have that record Monuments, get out there and get it. If you've never seen them live, get out there and see them. And it will blow your mind that this woman has some kind of vocal anxiety, because that's one of the most confident rock stars I've seen ever. All right? Lauren Larson from Ume. Okay, guys, we're going to wrap it up. I got one more conversation here for you. And this one is extremely special to me because I saved this one for last because I wanted to say this is what my show is about. I saw these guys, the Mastersons, husband and wife, musical team, Chris and Eleanor. I saw them play with Steve Poltz, talked to Poltz. I said, hey, can you help me? He hooked it up. They came on the show. Okay, well, they came in strangers. And they left the podcast friends. We've stayed in touch. We haven't gotten to hang out. But I know that they feel it, and so do I. I feel like we're friends after that hour that they sat here. We sat here and we talked. And they just got real with me right from the get-go. All right, so what you're about to hear is pretty much the first part of the podcast, the very beginning of it. And they opened up to me about what it's like being a couple in a band. And now, look, it's a real thing that I'm going for. I'm not saying like, oh, look, see people fight. No, I'm just saying like these guys came in, they sat down, and when I asked them what it was like to be them, they didn't go like, oh, it's great. They said, you know what? It's intense, man, and this is why. And that's what I'm going for on this show. So I want to thank Chris and Eleanor, who are now my friends, the group The Mastersons. Their record Good Luck Charm is out. It's amazing. You heard Uniform, which is my jam from that album right now on the last one. And so, look, let's talk to them. They're fantastic people, an amazing band, and this is really what I'm trying to get at with this show is this kind of truth and realness, okay? So here we go. Chris and Eleanor, The Mastersons. Let's get down. Let me ask you a question. This is going to be the first question of the whole thing. Can I hire you as a stylist?
Thank you.
Because I just went through like your Facebook pictures and I was like, God, every day this guy is just... Even when there's like a couple pictures where you're just like in a t-shirt and jeans, totally awesome. Like today, great boots. Eleanor, thanks. You as well, but I don't want to dress like a lady.
I understand.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
We used to share jeans for a long time. When
you did?
When I was younger.
Yeah, when we first started. One of our first dates, we both were like trying on the same pairs of jeans, shopping.
You went shopping for one of your first dates?
Yeah.
Where?
We actually went to the like citywide garage sale, I think.
No, but it was like, right? it was at the Palmer events. It's not the...
Yeah, that's a citywide.
It's like, but they do. It was all the clothing stores. It's, okay. It's like a more Le Garage sale or something like right. that. This was like.
How did you guys meet? Ago. Did you guys meet here in town? You live here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We met at a festival in Colorado, and I was playing with this guy, Jack Ingram. And
yeah.
She was playing with Susan Gibson, and there was this like sort of bad after party that neither one of us really wanted to be at.
Right.
And we were like cowering in the corner and. You know, some days it pays to be a wallflower.
Yeah. And that's how you met? What did you, like, what was, did Chris have a line or did, did you have like a smooth line to like work it over?
I don't really remember. I think we were both kind of cowering at the party and then like there were some instruments that came out and like he heard me play and like, I don't know, we just kind of.
No, she had a boyfriend at the
boyfriend,
time. She kind of dropped
so
that
I had,
card.
I had
like,
to tell him that pretty quickly, but then I just came home and broke up with a boyfriend, and here we are.
Wow. Was it because of Chris you broke up with him, or that was already kind of going?
It was already in the works. It was already in the works.
Chris was kind of the straw.
Yeah, he was the catalyst. So.
So I'm fascinated, A, with relationships, and B, with how people work and maintain a relationship. You guys have, like... A couple of times I've seen you, you have a magic kind of together on stage. Not kind of, but you do. There's obviously, I'm not the only person that thinks that. But how do you keep stuff separated? That's
no.
what I wonder.
No.
It's just one
not
big,
much.
It's one big blur of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're together all the time. We like very rarely have a moment apart, which is good most of the time. And other times it's pretty challenging. We're both pretty bullheaded and strong-willed about things and our opinions musically and otherwise. And so definitely makes it challenging sometimes when we're writing or, you know, just even trying to get through our to-do list.
Well, I mean, the easiest, you know, the interview question, the quick bullet point would be like the greater the level of intimacy, the lower the level of professionalism. And it's like we treat those we love in a different way, and it can be a good thing and a bad thing, you know, when you're trying to get something done.
Well, that's really interesting, that the higher the level of intimacy, the lower the level of professionalism.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Cause
if we all went
still
on a tour,
a lot of
if you hired
done,
us
you guys,
and yeah. we were like playing your songs and we got in a van, we would be like polite and, you know, in tune and on time and all those things that you try to do when you, you know, respect your job and want to get called back. But when it's the two of us, it's like the stuff that flies back and forth. I mean, and sometimes like outside of radio stations, it's like, oh yeah, well, fuck you. Oh yeah, well, okay, let's go. I can fake this. Like we could have just had a big blowout in the car and you wouldn't even know it.
Well, that's weird. It's her birthday.
We didn't today. No.
He's on his best behavior.
I'm so glad you guys are here. All right, so I was listening to... Real genuine people, man. I was glad they were here that day. I wish they'd come back right now. I love them, the Mastersons. I love their music, and they're genuinely great people. Amazingly talented as well, by the way. Thank you. They're in Steve Earle's band, in case you didn't know. Okay, look, that's it. Man, we've made 300 episodes of this show. Can you believe that? I can't believe it. We've made them, made it through it, and now we're on to 301, 302, and now we're making our way up to 400 episodes. Good God, man. One episode at a time. That's how I take it. I'll tell you the truth. That is how I take it. Man, I want to thank all of the artists that have come by. All of the artists that have been so cool. All the regular people that have come by. All the publicists that have helped out putting shows together. Namely, Juice Consulting. I work so much with them. I just want to thank Heather and Amber personally for being such great people. Hopefully, they're listening to this show. Listen, I can't thank you enough. I can't thank you guys enough. I'm glad that I have this place to talk about my life. on twice a week. You know, I come out and talk about it. I get to get together with people and get to know people. I get to insight into people's lives, insight into my own life through talking to people. And hopefully you're getting something out of it too, man. That's what it's all about. And hopefully throughout the whole thing, we're all having a great fucking time. I am. I'm telling you, man, this has really been a great fucking thing in my life, this podcast. It has opened up great doors for me. It has shined a new light on me for myself, and given me, I think, the ability to listen a lot better than I ever have in my life. So, and that's really important, I think, as you get older. Look, I'm not here to bum you out or be freaky, but I've got this microphone and I've got this time. And this is my fucking show. So I'm going to talk as long as I want. Thank you guys for listening. And thank you for being a part of this. I'm looking forward to bringing more shows. Let's go all the way to 400. See what happens there. Keep on going from there. Keep on talking to people. If you're in a band, you got stuff going on, let me know. I want to know what's going on with you. Send me records. Send me music. Send me t-shirts. Send me stickers. I love it all, man. I love it all. Thank you to everyone that's helped out with this show. Thank you to everyone, okay? Thanks to all the managers, all the bands, all the publicists. Thank you to you, the listeners. You guys are fantastic. Don't forget, you can always listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us on Stitcher. You can like our Facebook page, and you can follow me on Instagram and on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy, okay? I'm thinking about you. How Did I Get Here is now 300 episodes in. See you on Tuesday for episode 301. Let's get down, bitches.